topic is proof of the higher self. And thinking about this, we begin asking questions about what is the self? And what self are you talking about? Do I have more than one self? You know, because I certainly sometimes I have different viewpoints. I have different perceptions. And they change. So what is this self that we are trying to prove? And if it's higher, knowing that we live in this world of contrast, there must be a lower. So if we can prove to ourselves that there's a lower self and understand how it operates, then we have a beginning to that proof of the higher self. It's a basis for perhaps looking at it, what is higher. We know that Theosophy teaches us that there's like three souls that inhabit this being. You know, they're associated with the mind and our higher principle of Buddhi. But we know and we are told that the highest principle, Atma, it is so pure and spiritual that it does not manifest. It can't, because it is too pure. So it needs a vehicle. And in Theosophy, we call that vehicle Buddhi, the storehouse of knowledge, compassion, sublime, the highest state, Nirvana. But these states are what we call the monad. These states exist in all of life. But in the human form, mind is manifest. And mind is of a dual nature. There is a higher and a lower to mind. And we know that because we are told that we have a spiritual soul, we have a human soul, and we have an animal soul. And these three manifest. But the ability of a self-conscious being is to choose. Well, what are we choosing? Well, right now we are choosing our reality. Our self is based upon what we feel, what we see, what we smell, what we taste, what our senses take in. That's ourself. That's what we try to protect. That's what we try to nourish. We try to find peace with it. It's that monkey mind, that animal soul, that curious entity that's always searching and looking and prying and trying to find the answer, always active. But then we have the human mind, which we are able to see that man is living in this mansion of death, this mansion of suffering, where death is a constant companion. So this idea of self is really based upon what we think and how we act. That is the self of matter. How we think and act creates the self of matter. But the illusion is, matter is impermanent. So matter is not real in that sense. But we are told that the self of matter and the self of spirit can never meet because they are relative, not absolute. There could not be two absolutes. So the souls or the spirits, the animal, human, and divine are being chosen by that human principle in the middle, the balance principle, the bridge between matter and mind, or matter and spirit. Mind is that bridge. So the proof that we have a higher mind is found in the lower. We see in the lower that we have no peace. We have no calm. If this lower mind, this monkey mind, is not taught how to be quiet and is not given loving instructions on how to be, it's not that it wants to be mischievous. It is just curious and full of playfulness and life. So we have to discipline it. We have to discipline it with love and compassion, so that if we do that to ourselves, we can do it to others. So there's a expression or a reading from the Bhagavad Gita, you know, that about the self. So if we've established that we have two selves, a lower self and a higher self, we can read the Bhagavad Gita and understand what is being talked about, who Arjuna is, who Krishna stands for. But this very simple idea of this higher and lower self. So if we understand that, how can we transcend our present state? And that is only through control of our thoughts and our deeds. So the journey to find find that proof of a higher self is one of self inquiry. Here's a short phrase from the Bhagavad Gita. And it uses the term self in two different ways. So from the gist of what it says, let's see if one can discern what is being said. He should raise the self by the self. Let him not suffer the self to be lowered. For self is the friend of self. And in like manner, self is its own enemy. Self is the friend of the man who is self-conquered. So self, like a foe, hath enmity to him who is not self-conquered. Well, that's the beginning of that proof of the higher self, because I know that there's a lower self that I've been fighting with all of my life. And all of us have. So to discern the lower, or I should say to discern the higher, one must discern the lower. And that is the reality in which we live. So the second panelist will give us a little more insight into the proof of the higher self. Unmute.
Try again. If we're going to travel on this path of proving to ourselves the higher self, we need to define what we're looking for, have a clear destination in view. So we begin with definitions. What is meant by the higher self? The higher self is the essential spiritual being in each human being. However, unlike the personal self, which we had described, and the individual self, which is the thinker, which we also had described, it does not distinguish one human being from another. It has been called the universal self, the one universal self, the divine principle or spirit, the God within, and in Sanskrit, the term is used of Atma, which is the equivalent of spirit. Now, definitions, words are interesting, but analogies and correspondences can also appeal to our intuition and imagination. So if one were to compare this one universally diffused spirit with the sunlight, which shines equally on each and all, then the higher self is a sunbeam, which is essentially indistinguishable and inseparable ray of the one divine spirit. So the relationship between the sunbeam and sunlight is pretty much the same as the relationship, if we want to use that word, between our higher self and the universal self. It's one in essence, indistinguishable and inseparable. So what proof, what evidence, what logical reasoning can we assume to establish the fact of the higher self and the truth that the higher self, or essential spiritual being, is one with and inseparable from the universal spirit of all, which we may call deity if we wish. So let's begin with a premise, a place from which we can start our investigations. If the one universal spirit is the same in all beings, then we should be able to detect its presence within ourselves through looking within and through self-examination. So ultimately, we can use discussions and logical reasoning, but ultimately, proof of the higher self is an individual path of self-discovery. And yet, that path should be the same for each and all, each and every human being. So we want proofs that will not help not only us, but those who may not be trained in philosophical argument or discussion or even familiar with theosophy, but still have the capacity, because they are thinkers and capable of self-reflection and self-examination, to discover these proofs within themselves. So how do we learn? How do we all learn as human beings? Well, we learn by asking questions, for one thing, and we learn by contrast, as was pointed out. Light and dark, up and down, hot and cold, we learn all these things through the experience of opposites. And so too, we can use that principle. So we look within ourselves, or we ask the question, is there some essential basis of our being that is changeless in the midst of all the changing aspects of our nature? So looking within, we see we have a variety of feelings, a variety of intensity of those feelings, and those feelings react differently under different circumstances. And they define the way our personality is, and that changes. We have a variety of different sensations and sensitivities to sounds, to colors, to heat, to touch, and the impressions we get also determine the way we view ourselves and our environment, our personality. We say we are a very sensitive individual, or we are very aware of the feelings of others. We sense that. Besides that, we also have the physical features of our bodies, which are changing all the time, in fact, but we can definitely recognize periods of our life when the features of our bodies change. And of course, we also have different opinions, different conclusions, different ideas, different theories, different thoughts. These are the most changing aspect of ourselves, and yet they in themselves define our personalities. And all these things are changing. So we say, well, if we take away all these changing aspects of our personality, if we take away the feelings, the march of ideas, the march of sensory impressions, the changes of our body, is there anything left which we can identify that doesn't change? We'll just leave that question hanging for a while for you to think about. So then we ask ourselves, looking within, is there some essential basis of our being that is indestructible and internal in its nature? In other words, whatever experience we've been through, the most shameful, hurtful, the greatest joy, whatever it is, and everything in between, is there anything in our nature that's been unaffected, not destroyed by all that variety of experience from the time we were born till the present day, and by extension, we can say into the future? Is there anything? Let's leave that question hanging for a while too. And finally, we say, is there some essential basis of our being that is and yet is not? Meaning that we know that it is, it hasn't changed, it hasn't been destroyed, but it can't be defined. It has no qualities, no attributes by which we can identify it. Now, we know what a rock is. We say it is because it has weight, it has texture, it has color, and we can throw it against something, it has sound, it has attributes. Same way with plants and animals. The scientists have a field day classifying all the different species according to their attributes. But is there something in our nature that isn't a species, so to speak, doesn't have any distinguishing characters, so it is not as a distinct being, and yet it is? Let's leave that question hanging for a while too. Because all these questions force us to look within and examine for ourselves and see what we're left. And we can only know it through our minds, our ability to be self-conscious and aware. And it can only come to us through our awareness, our consciousness, what we know. And when we do that, we say, the only thing that I can identify that is changeless, not disturbed, not destructive, has no features, is that awareness of identity. Now, we hate to use the term I, because the Spanish would say yo, and the Germans would say ich. So we'll say I because we're all English speaking, but it doesn't come through as that word I. It comes through as the feeling of individual self-conscious identity. Okay, I am I. I am that I am. And if we think about it, it's always there. It hasn't changed. Our thoughts change, our feelings change, our sensations change, but I am still always I. And it hasn't been affected. I was shamed, I was praised, I was congratulated, I was condemned, but it's still the same I. And that hasn't been destroyed, that's still there. And you can't weigh I, you can't say it has a certain color or texture or features. It's just I, it is, but it is not. Not only that, it's the same I in every human being. So it's the beginning by which we can prove to ourselves that there is something in our nature that is like that deific principle. One and inseparable, changeless, constant, and eternal. And we're practically proving to ourselves what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita in the second chapter about the spirit within cannot be destroyed by anything that comes to pass. The fire burneth it not, the water corrupteth it not, the wind drieth it not away. I'm sure you're all familiar with the passage. But we can prove that for ourselves. But that's just the beginning. That's just the theoretical. We really have to get out there and apply it. He who lives the life learns the knowledge. It's like studying all the books on chess there are. That doesn't make you a grandmaster. You get a grandmaster by playing, you get to become a grandmaster by playing thousands of games and winning a certain number of them. You get into the Baseball Hall of Fame by getting on base 3 out of 10 times. But you got to do it. You got to get out there and practice, apply it. So we truly learn and realize by first identifying with that I that we've discovered. And what do we usually identify with? Well, we usually identify with the personality, all those changing things. I am this person with this complexion, with these physical features, with this amount of energy today, with these aches and pains. with these limitations, with these faults, with these virtues, with these abilities, with these skills. We identify with all that. And we sort of go into a crisis when one of those things which we really cherish about ourselves is disrupted. We go into what's called an identity crisis because we've identified with it. And of course, we also identify with ourselves as thinkers, thinking beings. But once again, we are dealing with those things which separate or distinguish us from other human beings. So we need to practice the idea of drawing back and identifying with that I, which is the same in each and all. And it's an interesting thing. What we think about, what we identify with, we become. We become one. The way we think, therefore we are. In that sense. But that's also a way on the path. Now we got to begin to meditate on it. We got to begin to dwell on it. We got to think about it, compare, contrast it with all the changing aspects of life. We dwell on it. We identify with it. We think about it. And the third step is we begin to act from that basis, not from the basis of personal separate beings, not from the basis of individual souls in evolution of different degrees, but think and act and speak and react to the best we can from the basis of that one self in each and all. He who lives the life knows the doctrine. So we've tried to point out a way, a path by which we can prove to ourselves through self-study, through self-discipline, as was suggested, a way to prove for ourselves through self-evident ideas that this higher self is a fact and the truth that is one and identical with the divine self of all. And there is no difference between that self and the self of any other being. So we'll stop here and give you a chance to ask some questions and make some comments. MJW.
Yes. Yes, two very interesting talks. Thank you both. So the first speaker talked about, you know, there aren't two absolutes. And the second speaker was talking a lot about the I. But we've come across somewhere in the teachings that there is a concept of two I's. Could one or both of you comment on that?
Well, we'll start first. We think you're speaking of the personal I or the personal sense of identity of I. And the individuality or the individual I, universal in that sense. So in the second presentation, you spoke about that I, or that sense of identity, which is the same in each and all, that has the qualities of being divine and spiritually one with deific principle, changeless, constant, eternal, unaffected, absolute, unconditioned. So that's the individuality, the I in that sense. And perhaps the first presenter can talk about the personal I, how that is different from it.
Well, we certainly know what the personal I is. And we've grown up with it. You know, that's how we came to the point we are now. You know, we've relied upon our feelings, our sensations, you know, all of that, all of our senses, to accumulate knowledge and perspective, hopefully wisdom, but to grow. And we've been growing. And we've found that once we water the seeds that are growing in the mind, we see that change or life begins to expand. Because there are no limits on mind. So the personal self is necessary, is a means to an end, not an end in itself. That's what's the problem with the world. Everyone thinks that their body is who they are. Their feelings is, that's who they are. Why do we think worlds, you know, there are wars within the world.
So it's a necessary evil, would you say? The lower self, it's a necessary evil. It's a,
well, it's, we only make, we make it evil. And it's not.
JCS.
So what it is then is a necessary communion of mind, of spirit, of matter, and it is the point at which we can communicate with all of great nature as we know it. Not evil, an opportunity.
So there is only one I, one self. And yet, the way we experience it, the way it wells up in our awareness depends where our consciousness is focused. So it is a natural phenomenon. It's inherently without morality or cannot be judged as good or evil. We can say it's higher and lower in the sense that one aspect of that I, the way we perceive it, is closer to the universal. And the lower aspect, being formed from our identity with material conditions, the personality, is lower in the sense it's closer to material life. So we can say it's higher and lower, but we can't say it's good or bad. It's how we use. And certainly, we have to move from selfishness to being unselfish before we become selfless. So we take that principle of personal I, and instead of doing everything for its benefit, regardless, and its gratification, with regardless of what may happen to others, we begin to extend the circle, become more and more unselfish in our personalities, to expand it to the consideration and service of others. And through that, become more and more aware, through that discipline and practice and devotion, of the divine self in each and all, the true mystical religious experience, if you will. There is a chat that came in. And if one finds another acting from the monkey mind towards them, trying to define their changing identity, can acting in turn from a unity perspective control the situation? Or is the self not demonstrated in the same way as virtue? So to restate the question, and I think this is probably initially addressed to the first presenter, can we act, if somebody is acting towards us from the basis of their personality, their personal self, can we respond to that from the perspective of the higher self? And is that the same or different from being virtuous?
You know, this is very interesting because Friday night, we're going to be talking about the sin of speech. So how do we respond? That's an answer we each have to make for ourselves.
So we ask ourselves, well, what's the point? What's the point of demonstrating to ourselves the proof of the higher self? Well, it's to gain a greater conviction that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature. If we all proceed from oneself, our soul, our source, if we are all interconnected and one with oneself or source, and we all in our essential being can identify a principle that is one with all, then that can become a true basis by which to respond to our other selves who don't. And in that response, we are not only acting to, quote, control the situation, that's not the purpose so much, but rather through that interaction to perhaps assist that soul to a better realization of who and what they are and who and what they can be. The virtues are the tools, the means by which we accomplish that, through love, through patience, through harmony in the way we speak, through indifference to how they treat or react to us, through persistence, and through wisdom. They're the virtues, and we apply them to help nature and help all the beings involved in evolution in this great cycle.
MHW?
Yeah. We all have seen or maybe even experienced or been involved with a discussion that kind of turned hot with another person. But we know that if we don't get defensive, if we act from the higher and just remain calm and just not respond in kind, but respond with love and compassion, that the situation can be diffused at that point if we're acting from the higher.
I think it's been said that we are prone to act from the lower, from our everyday mind. That's where we live. And not to react in that mind, one has to have a presence in our higher mind. And that presence is achieved through concentration and meditation.
And so in that responding to that, it's not just being a matter of being silent or not saying something to further inflame the situation. Often it's a question to really listen. What is the person talking about? What are they reacting to in me or the situation that's bringing out? Try to understand what's going on, the viewpoint of the other person, and try to see life or circumstances the way they do. In other words, to be empathetic as well as compassionate. The more we don't identify with our own personalities and conditions, the more we don't do that, the better it is, the easier it is to identify with and recognize the conditions of others.
We think that we found profoundly important is that our thoughts and our acts create the self of matter. We've created this self, this lower self. You know, this is not our first time here. So it puts the burden of responsibility on oneself. And I think one thing that we're always asked to do, you know, in terms of selfish, unselfish, and selfless, is self-sacrifice. You know, there's so many definitions of the self or how it can be applied.
JCS?
Well, maybe the process of the internal dialogue, that practice of self-conscious reflection or introspection, is very similar to what we've been discussing about our reactions and actions with someone else lost in the personal. So key to the practice, the endeavor, would be as we move through the day to try to make the effort to be aware, is this the monkey mind thinking? Am I internally reacting with some kind of heat to the moment? How can I calm this down? How can I recenter? And that internal dialogue is what begins to unify the different selves that the speaker was just referring to. But it's the same process within each of us as opposed to what we practice without, with each other.
We have a question. It is spoken of as we have two selves, the higher and the lower, the personal and the universal. Is it possible for the personal self, the lower self, to become an instrument of the higher? Or does it have to be completely annihilated or destroyed by us? Can it be put in the service of the higher?
We think we've found, no, please go ahead, MHW. Yes, MH.
Well, we know that that's the only way that we can come in contact with the material world, which is where we have to be in order to learn our lessons, is by the lower self. So in a sense, we're using the lower self all the time. But it's a matter, we think it was the first speaker talked about keeping it under control. So that is one of the things the higher self, we would guess, have to do. But we need the lower self in order to be in contact with the world.
Yeah, that's why the analogy, the horse and the rider. You know, the horse is our lower nature. And if we do not guide it, it will run free and loose and do as it wishes. So I think we all know that animal.
MJW.
Yeah. In the same vein, the expression nature unaided fails, we have to foster universal brotherhood We have to be brotherly towards ourselves and our nature and see the unitary aspects of everything, that we're a part of it, we're affected by it. So we need to help ourselves. We need to aid our own nature in order to raise the self by the self and help the nature of all those around us to be more pleasant, more kind, more compassionate, more caring. We benefit ourselves, but we don't really think of ourselves, but we're doing it. And by not thinking of ourselves and working for the self of all, we are benefiting ourselves. But if we think about benefiting ourselves, it's to catch 22. We can't do it that way.
What's the saying? Slow down. You walk too fast. Stay and make the morning last.
So the lower self is, in a sense, the child of the parent, the higher self. And it was pointed out by another speaker that we've created this personal self by the way we've interacted with matter, the conditions and tendencies we set up that we identify with. But it is a useful tool. You know, the analogy of the monkey mind has been used several times. There's another analogy from the animal world that we've had described to describe this personal self, and that is the way the monkey or bear infant clings to the underside of its mother. And it's clinging, it's hanging on. And yet the lion cub is held suspended in the mouth of the mother and carried along that way and seems to be very content just hanging, not having to cling, but being held. And in the same way, we go through life like one of those two critters. We are either the bear or the monkey clinging, trying to hold on to that which is constantly changing around us, or we're very content just to sit back and observe it, recognizing that in our personal natures, in our true natures, we are one with the eternal. There, in our ultimate nature, we can depend on and rely on that higher and just observe what's going on around us as personalities and react to it, very content to just hang there and and be the witness. So in that way, the personality can be used in a variety of ways. And we want to get more of that less clinging to changing conditions and more like that creature that is aware, is functioning on this plane, but not dependent. It doesn't have to cling on it because it knows it can rely on its parent source.
There was mention of, you know, in the voice of the silence, it says here, the self of matter and the self of spirit can never meet. One of the twain must disappear. There's no place for both. Ere thy soul's mind can understand, the bud of personality must be crushed out. The worm of sense destroyed past resurrection. It's something to think about. You know, the idea that we struggle with this lower mind, but that struggle is how we learn. You know, because we identify with everything around us. And, you know, that identifying with is part of that universal brotherhood. You know, we see ourselves in everything. We're very sorry that we brought up that sin of speech. You don't have to stop now. You know, we can rise above all sin.
Silence is golden, too.
Yeah, right. Well, yes, MHW.
All right, so practically speaking, in 3 minutes then, what can we do to get this lower self to uncling and to be more functional in a higher realm? What can we do to do that, to merge them or at least to clean up the lower self?
Well, what do they say? What you pay attention to is what grows. If you don't pay attention to it, it's not getting any energy. It can't grow. It'll die. So you are in control.
We all come to this work as personalities trying to understand our unity. And there's a method. Unity, study, and work. The unity is that of altruism, brotherly feeling, sisterly feeling. The study is studying together these universal ideas, but also studying our lives, our natures in the light of ideas. And the work is beginning to apply that knowledge for others, working to upon ourselves, to recreate ourselves in the light of that wisdom, and also disseminate the ideas so others have the same opportunity. So there's three ways. And we owe it, that unity study work is the platform or the lines laid down by that teacher being who brought theosophy from the Mahatmas, the preservers of that wisdom down through the ages. Of course, we're speaking of H.P. Blavatsky. And like that sunbeam and the sunlight that are one and inseparable, H.P.B. and theosophy cannot be separated. We have to appreciate the two together, the message and the messenger. And so this coming Wednesday, for our local commemoration of her passing on May 8th, 1891, we will have our own local commemoration on May 5th, White Lotus Day. And we'll begin with three introductory readings from devotional books. Actually, we'll begin with a short biographical talk on her life. Three devotional readings, which she specified she would like students to read and consider on the commemoration of her passing. And also a talk on H.P. Blavatsky and theosophy. And as there will be some additional time, we invite you all to come to the meeting, perhaps with one or two quotes from her works that you have found particularly enlightening and useful and practical in your lives that you'd like to share with others at the meeting. So it should be a very devotional and inspiring meeting for all. And as was said, it would be helpful if you can join the meeting a few minutes early, perhaps 5 minutes early, in silent reflection and thought to help set the tone. So with that, we thank you all and have a good day.
Thanks. Thank you.